Number one, Star Wars. Number two, comics. Number three, Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. Number four, Mario. Number five, Weird Al. Number six, Batman. Number seven, Kal-El. Number eight, The Simpsons. Number nine, TV. Number ten, every single band that I stole all their MP3s, but before they all sold out, say it all together if you're with me now. Nerds ruin everything. Nerds ruin everything. Say nerds ruin everything.
Nerds ruin everything. Nerds ruin everything. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Nerds Ruin Everything. I'm Logan.
And I'm Matt.
And we're going to be talking about a bunch of stuff today. It's kind of a hodgepodge. You want to start with the CinemaCon stuff?
Yeah, let's start with the CinemaCon stuff.
All right. So if anybody who doesn't know, there's this thing that happens every year. It's basically for movie theater owners.
Yeah, exhibitors. Yep.
And it's called CinemaCon. All the companies show up with everything that they've got for basically the rest of the year and sometimes like early next year, kind of to entice those people into showing as much of their product as possible. And it's kind of become a Comic-Con for just movie stuff.
Yeah.
Only also, you and I can't really go. So
yeah, we have to be. You have to literally be an exhibitor or a high level journalist, because there were a lot of high level journalists that were there, reporting back on the stuff that they saw and stuff. You know, but like there's certain things that we're not going to even see until summer. Like the big one that I heard about that I kept on seeing people talk about was. Lord and Miller's Project Hail Mary, which is based off of the Andy Weir book, The guy who wrote The Martian, and just like hearing about like just the like it's like a big movie, like it's like big space movie. It's kind of like Andy Weir, so you get that kind of like sarcastic kind of humor in it, like that kind of like, you know, brevity that but it's like it's an original, it's not like an existing IP. I mean, it's an adaptation of a book, but that's the big one that I was hearing because it's Ryan Gosling, Lord and Miller, space, and it's like, you know, the footage that they saw, which was like, I think it amounted to like 7 or 8 minutes of footage, was kind of like everybody flipped their lids for it. So my wife actually read the book and she really loved it. She loved it a lot. She wants me to read it and I've just not gotten around to it, but it's definitely on my list. So I'll probably be reading it soon, but there's a lot of things like that come up, but then we kind of get certain things out of it, which is kind of nice. We got a couple of trailers, like we got a clip, we got an extended clip of Lilo and Stitch, which I wanted to ask you about. What did you think about that?
So I was real nervous to hit play and watch that, like real nervous.
Yeah.
I think it is as perfect as an adaptation like that can be. It's funny. Stitch sells it. So they have done a wonderful job from that footage and everything we've seen so far of capturing what makes Stitch in the original movie, the spinoffs, the cartoon series, what makes him so lovable. And that's the best thing they could do. It's still a bunch of actors acting with something that isn't there. And unfortunately, I think that's kind of telling. I think the only one who's actually pretty good in that scene, actual actors, live action actors, is the girl. I think she's pretty good. Like, it feels kind of natural, you know, but everybody else, it feels a little stilted. Now that's like 3 minutes of a probably 90 minute movie, maybe 100 minutes, whatever it's going to wind up being. So I don't want to be like super harsh. Nothing put me off the movie though. Like I'm still excited to see it. Stitch, like I said, he looks great. I will be infinitely glad my entire life that I just blanked on his name, that he is just like, no, I'm Stitch. Like, and that they're letting him do it, you know?
Yeah, they absolutely are.
Sanderson? Is that
Sanderson? Chris Sanderson.
Yeah, Chris Sanderson. Yeah. Having anybody else do that, I don't know. Like, you could probably kind of imitate it, but it's just, it's him.
It really is him. Like, it's like, I don't even it's not, there's just nothing that compares to the original person that does this kind of stuff. Like, you have to go back.
It's like, I hate to bring up Looney Tunes, and we don't need to get off on a rant. Although, we're getting Coyote versus Acme, and that's exciting. Ketchup still can't open a movie. Maybe not all their fault, but it's still exciting. But, like, listening to anybody in the last 20 years, 30 years, maybe even 40 years, do Bugs Bunny or any of those characters, and then go back, you can't anymore, but go back and watch those original cartoons, and it's like, oh, they're kind of doing a version of Mel Blanc, but it's not really there.
Yeah, it's really not the same. Yeah, like, and like, yeah, I mean, it's so kind of like, you know, the Looney Tunes is like kryptonite or plutonium for us right now. I'm happy that Ketchup gets to release it. And luckily, they're talking 2026. So that gives them time to like game plan. Like, yeah. I was going to be really disappointed. Like, I know, like,
if it was just this rush job of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, they're really actually giving it consideration, which I'm all about. Like, I'd rather have them wait and do it right and get it right and it be a hit than it be something that just, like you said, half-assed, like, just shove it out there because we want it. Like, I'm at a point now where it's like, I mean, it's been completed since the end of 2023. So by the time it gets released, it'll be 2.5 years. So it's not a big deal, right? Like, it's not a big deal that they wait. So
I mean, we're waiting. Well, between Avatar 1 and Avatar 2, it was how long? So. And I know that's a bigger production and it involves more stuff, but it's not like we haven't had to wait for a movie before. And, you know, it's probably not a bad thing. We're going to get to see it eventually. That's the most important thing. But, I thought the Lilo and Stitch footage was good. Not excellent, but good. Lilo and Stitch adjacent. I don't know if this came out of CinemaCon, but I think it did because the reaction I read was to the footage of How to Train Your Dragon. That it was absolutely wonderful. Of course, we're probably not going to get to see that footage. The movie opens pretty soon, so we'll probably have another trailer here in a week or so.
We actually did get a trailer.
Put out a new trailer? I didn't watch
it. It was like literally when they brought out the 15, like, cause they had like a 15 minute package.
Yeah.
I think it was literally like the first 15 minutes and then like, or the first encounter between, Toothless and Hiccup. But yeah, they did release a new trailer.
I'm going to go see it. So the trailer does nothing to sell the movie to me. It can only hurt. It can't make me more excited or more willing to go see it. So, by all accounts, it looks wonderful. And then they dropped, by the way, we're on to How to Train Your Dragon 2.
Yeah, that's how confident they are, which I'm kind of loving. I love the fact that they're like... because they're on a clock with the kids. Yeah. Like, let's be honest. It's not like the animated movies that, like, were over 8 years or 9 years, I think it was. And they could do that. This is like, they're on a time clock with these kids. Like, they're only going to have a finite amount of time. So, like, if they're going to do a trilogy, then they need to start production right now on the first, the second one. And then pretty much after the second one is done, probably go into the third one as well. So,
yeah.
But I mean, it does show confidence, right? Like you kind of like to see that. You kind of like to see that.
It's
like
not something that we get a lot of. Like Marvel has been doing that, of course. Warner Brothers thought they were doing it, but faltered at every single step. They're kind of doing it now.
They really are.
Like, it's not really anything we've seen from a studio outside of that since like Harry Potter.
Yeah, since Harry Potter. And Harry Potter was such a like regardless of what it is now, like at the time it was a thing. Like, you know, there are kids that have grown up in the shadow of Harry Potter, and like, you know, it's like there was, like, you know, I don't know, like, yeah, like other than that, there's not much else out there that does that. So it just invokes confidence, but it also, like, it shows the kind of care that Universal and DreamWorks are taking with this series, and they understand what they have. Like, I think that it's like one of those things where, you know, a studio could be cheap and crass about it, a la Warner Brothers, you know, but they're not, like, thankfully they're not. And like I said, I can think of more imbues about confidence than box office. Like, you know, it's more about the confidence that they have with what they're seeing. And I mean, they did it the right way, right? Like, they, like, every step of the way, it feels like they've done everything that they could possibly do to respect how beloved this trilogy is, and how much, like, I will not be surprised if Cate Blanchett gets announced. Like, that's how confident, that's the kind of ballsy thing that they could do and pull off. Like, especially if this next one is like, I'm almost wondering if they're gonna wait for this one to like come out and just show her, and then it'll be like, yeah, Cate Blanchett, you know, because, you know, that's who she was. Like, that's, yeah. I mean, like, it just makes sense to me, right? Like, if you're gonna do Gerard Butler, and I mean, like, I will tell you this much, the trailer is a little bit more like centric on the story between like, you know, the dragons versus the humans. And I will say, like somebody woke Gerard Butler the fuck up. Like, that's the one question I had, and they woke him the fuck up. Or he's just like, you know, it's just like the Scottish in him is like pumped into his blood, and he just kind of like, you know, original accent, and it works. And it's like there's one of the, like, key, like, you hear one of the key moments and one of the key arguments, and it just, it's chilling because of how, like, and then you see him, and it's like, Jesus, like, yeah, no, this is gonna work. And the effects work is just, it looks great. Like, I don't know how they did it, but they managed to make all of the dragons look like they do, but they interact with the humans in a way that it doesn't feel false. Like, do you know what I mean? Like they still look cartoony, but they don't. And especially Toothless, like, they somehow managed to make him look real. I don't know. It's wild. Like, it's wild. It's really wild for me to like watch this stuff and go, yeah, like, a decade and a half ago or a decade ago, we were watching this first one, and it just like now we're getting a live action version of it, but with the utmost respect. But yeah, like, you know, it's the movie of the summer for me, like, other than Superman. Like, but Superman is more of a question mark. Like, it's still a question mark, right? For me, at least. But this one is just like, yeah, this is the movie for the summer for me. I'm going to go see it like 5 times and probably cry my eyes out every time I watch it, because I can't even get through the first one without, like, the second one and the third one are like whatever, but that first one is so special. Especially if you've, like, you know, you've had a dog or a pet in your life and they mean something to you. Like, yeah. I mean, that's like, it's literally that generation's like Old Yeller or whatever you want to call it. So yeah, no, Definitely. Actually, you know what? I think they might have seen the whole movie. Like, thinking about it now, like, I think they might have seen the whole movie. Like that's how, like, that's what Universal did, I think. I'll look it up while we talk about, I mean, in talking about question marks. Superman, they dropped a 5 minute, like, they, I don't know if it's a trailer as much
well,
as
I mean,
like,
a lot of it look. Was stuff we've already seen. So,
yeah, but also contextually larger moments. Yeah, like, yeah. It gave us, like, fuller, breathable moments of those things, right? Like, I mean, it basically showed us what everybody is proposing the opening moment. Like, you know, like the, like, you know, this opening moment with Crypto and Superman, and then him going to the, oh, go ahead.
The Crypto scene. So, you texted me about the footage and I hadn't had a chance to watch it. So, I finally got around to watching it, and it's perfectly James Gunn. Like, the original Crypto footage we saw was so emotionally charged, and the full scene, while it is emotional, is so goofy, but not in a bad way. It's just undercuts that emotionality so much. And like Crypto, like, he has had the shit kicked out of him. Clearly, he is, like, he can't get up to move. And Crypto is just, like, pouncing on him. And I'm just like, yeah, this happens to me, like, every morning. Like,
yep. Your dog gives no fucks about your current condition.
Like, come on, let's go.
Yep. It was wonderful because it's like this, like, you know, like you said, like, it's emotionally charged, but it's like Gunn completely undercuts it with a dog being a dog, like Crypto being a like, and I think that that's what sells it. I mean, because we know that it's a CG dog, but the way that he interacts with Superman and like jumping on him and like, play, let's go. Oh, and then that moment of, oh, okay, I know what I need to do. Yeah. Like, it's just, it's so great. Like it's like, I feel like they're selling this because they, like, more than anything, I think that, like, they, like, Gunn knows where his bread is buttered. And yeah, you know, there's going to be the Lois and Clark stuff. And, like, you know, they're talking about that, about how, like, they also saw additional footage, and I guess like there's, like, you know, there's true chemistry there. But I feel like Gunn is the guy that makes Crypto and Soup the heart and soul of the movie. And I think that that's what we're kind of getting soft sold here. And I could be wrong. I could be very wrong, but it feels like you don't put that as your first image that you see in the trailer unless you're selling Crypto and Superman as like this cosmic tale, the superhero tale of a boy and his dog, and like a relationship movie as well. But it realistically is like a boy and his dog, at least to me. I don't know. I could be very wrong.
Yeah. It's going to be interesting to see how he's able to combine so many elements. I'm guessing part of that is going to be lack of origin stories, which I can't tell you how much I appreciate that we're not going to get another Superman origin story. You know, I'm sure it'll be like, oh, you know, I came here on a rocket ship, you know, when I was a baby and they found me. But it won't be, I mean, how much of every Superman movie, well, there's really not that much, because most of them are sequels, but, you know.
But I mean, the first two, the Superman 78, the first 45 minutes is an origin story.
Yeah.
But, and then Snyder does the same fucking thing. Like, 35 minutes of it is the origin story. So, like, you're getting of a 2.5 hour, possibly 3 hour movie, you're getting 30 extra minutes back. And that's 30 extra minutes you can litter with a bunch of characters and context and stuff. Like, yeah, I'm actually very excited that we know, like he's even said that there's no origin thing here. It's not necessary because he's already been Superman. And he's been Superman for a while. So it's like jumping into the context of the world in which he lives in and the people that are around him. And because it's a bigger world, the more exciting part also is everybody that he's bringing in. Like, you know, the like DCEU adjacent people that he's deciding to bring into this story. And what I like is, and what I trust, and I feel like you probably are the same way, is there's always a purpose for him bringing in characters, right? He never just brings in a character because, like, and especially in his Guardian movies, he never brought in characters that were for spectacle. He brought them in for purpose, right? Like, you know, so I feel like him, like, he's probably, like, he's doing the same thing with Superman. It's not like Hot Girl is there because it's like, you know, he wants to make 35 Hot Girl movies. Like, it's not, it's very anti-Snyder in the way that Snyder approached things, you know, because, like, this is the difference between caring about Superman and hating Superman. Like, and I can't help but punch down on Zack Snyder because of the fact that he said very early on, he did not like Superman. It's like, why the fuck are you doing the movie then? You know, why don't you just do your fucking Martha stupid ass Batman movie that you always wanted to do? Why did we take on Superman? Like, you know, it was very like, you know, and we got exactly what we got, that version of Superman, right? Like, we got a version of Superman that he, like, you know, that it was great because Cavill made it great, but it was hampered by so much crap.
Yeah.
You know, like, the first film is like, oh, okay, so you're going to have Superman kill somebody. Okay, that's cool, you fucking asshole. And then the sequel is not even a fucking Superman movie. It's a Batman movie.
Yeah.
And then Justice League, he spends the entire time being a CGI asshole. Like, literally a CGI asshole. Like, in his version, he wakes up from his tomb and tries to kill the Justice League in a CGI face because of the mustache. Thank you, Tom. I do have to say, like, I do love it. That's like the biggest punk move that Tom Cruise ever did was like, no, he's not shaving the mustache. You guys fucking figure it out. I don't need to help you guys out. Fuck you. Go ahead.
What underlying is, like, years later he would come out and be like, I saw The Flash, it's excellent, everybody should go see this movie. And I'm like,
yeah,
why didn't you just trash that movie, man?
I know, seriously.
Since we're on Tom Cruise, I do think, I mean, I'm glad he got on stage and was like, you know what? Like, I'm going to talk about Val Kilmer.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about that in a minute. But, like, I thought that was really, really sweet.
He had to fight for Kilmer to come back in the sequel,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, Paramount did not want him.
Yeah.
Which I find wild. Because the heart of that movie, like, the big chunk of why that worked is because of Val Kilmer. Like, it's so wild to me. Like, you never bet against Tom Cruise. Like, especially when he's like, why would you do that? But anyways, like, yeah. You can say what you want about Cruise, but, like, the thing that I feel like is ultimately, and what CinemaCon is about is, like, you know, theaters first, to which, like, I'm always about, like, you know, especially because streaming sucks. Like, a lot of the stuff that we get from streamers, like, movies that we get from streamers are, they're the doldrums, man.
Yeah.
They really are. Not to say that some of the stuff that we've been getting recently in the theaters is great, but I mean, it's influenced by streaming, right?
Yeah.
Like, But yeah, Cruz talking about Kilmer, like, you could see, like, the thing that I took away from it was there was a true friendship there.
Yeah.
Like, there was, like, there was true, like, you know, there's often times where, like, Cruz is like a robot, right? Like, you know, he's like, he got the star persona, but, like, there's, like, cracks in the armor. And that's what I took away from, like, him talking about that for a little bit. You could see the crack in the armor and well, go, oh, he's human.
I mean, since we're talking about Kilmer, let's, mm-hmm. I mean, there was a few more things at CinemaCon, but most of it's, I think you said, stuff we haven't had a chance to even see yet. Like, apparently Fantastic Four lit the fucking building on fire.
Yeah.
But we don't get to see that trailer probably for another week or two.
Yeah.
Include it, it had the debut of Silver Surfer, like, at, you know, confirmation that kind of sort of spoilers that Vanessa Kirby's character is pregnant. We're getting a Franklin Richards thing.
Yes.
So anyway, we'll talk about that when it does drop. But like, there was a lot of good stuff. Kind of makes me feel hopeful about the last, you know, 8 months of this year. At least the theaters will be a kind of a haven away from the shit that is going on outside of them.
Yeah, let's not even. Yeah. Thank God.
So this past week, Val Kilmer passed away.
Yeah.
And, I mean, he had not been well for a while. He had completely lost his voice, right? Mm-hmm. Because of cancer. I think other than showing up in Maverick and a cameo in Jay and Silent Bob Reboot, I don't think he'd been in anything for a very long time.
No. If you watch the document, which is the perfect time to actually talk about this documentary, the documentary Val, it actually talks about that and his, like, you know, like him losing his voice and stuff, and how he was very, like even before he was doing the Mark Twain stuff, like he was doing a roadshow of like this one man Mark Twain show that he had created, which was a fascinating,
super passionate about. Like, you know, he was absolutely fascinated with Mark Twain, and you know, I know he did it for a while, and it's mm-hmm. just a damn shame he didn't get to continue to do it. Because he loved doing it so much.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, like, that was preoccupying his time. And especially because, I mean, he was honest. He was like, you know, I'm a little bit difficult. And I know this. And I'd rather do something like this than get on a set. And everybody is, like, you know, pushing against everything that I do as an actor. You know, he was very method. Especially in roles that he was very passionate about, i.e., like, I mean, you can tell, like, you know, Tombstone, Heat, The Doors, especially The Doors. That's where he got his.
He auditioned for, I think, if I remember the story right, he auditioned for The Doors, like, as Jim Morrison.
Yep.
Like, yep. Showed up in the leather pants and the, like, half open shirt, and like, that's how he came to the audition.
Yep. And like, I mean, like, all you need to do, like, if, like, I would suggest anybody, even if they are not a fan of, like, you know, The Doors, watching the movie The Doors, because I feel like it's his magnum opus. Like, as much as people want to say Tombstone, and I actually watched Tombstone yesterday. But like, The Doors is the one for me. Like, and in true like Hollywood fashion, did not get an Oscar nomination, got nothing out of it. And it's like, but it's also a very dark and disturbing and ugly portrait of a star who was gripped with alcoholism and drug addiction. Like, it very much so is exactly that. Like, and it's it's a magnetic performance. Like, I think it's his best work. For me, hands down, his best work. It's the thing that I remember. I saw that in the theater opening night. Like, could you imagine my parents actually let me go see that?
That's wild.
I mean, both of them were like, you know, 60s kids. And so they knew Morrison. I mean, they grew up in LA. The Doors are like one of the ultimate LA bands, right? But I got to see it like at 13 years old or something. Well, let's see, it was 91. So, yeah, I was 13.
So do you think it's because he never shied away from the fact that he could be difficult to work with.
Yeah.
Do you think that's why he kind of like post, what, 90s or maybe early 2000s? For the most part, he was relegated to like these like shitty B movie collect a paycheck kind of things.
Honestly, yeah. I think that, I mean, he actually talks about it in Val. Like, he talks about
catch up with that.
It's a wonderful, the thing that's going to like break your heart is that the documentary is actually like you go, how the hell did they fucking use some AI thing? And then you realize they say it, that his son Jack is the one that's doing the voiceover, and he sounds just like him. He's like there are two, I hate to be so crass, but there's two Nepo babies right now out there that I feel are going to follow in their father's footsteps. One of them is Ray Nicholson, Jack Nicholson's son. If you like, I saw a movie called Borderline. It's probably one of my favorite movies of the year so far, and it's because of Ray Nicholson, because he's so good as like, and he's so much like he is, but he isn't his son, his father's son, right? Like, he has a different aura, as the kids say nowadays. But Jack Kilmer, his son, has been in a few things, and once he figures it out, the kid's going to be huge. He has whatever his dad had, like, but yeah, like, you know, he definitely talks about it and how, like, it was, you know, he knew, like, he was very difficult because he was so passionate about it. Like, his thing was that he was very passionate about it. But passion,
I mean, this is a guy who, like, his first movie wasn't a hit, but he was the star of his first movie. I mean, Top Secret was the first thing he ever did, and that was out the gate, the star of the movie.
And he's so, like...
It's really funny, man. It's so really funny. And then, you know, Real Genius was, you know, literally right after that, and... Again, not another hit, but a movie that became this cult thing on video.
Yep, it was one of those first HBO VHS movies that everybody fell in love with. I actually have, like, you know, the yellow gorilla shirt? I actually have that shirt.
Yeah?
Yeah, I actually, like, so, weird quick story about that shirt. So part of the reason why I love that movie is because my dad, as a kid, my dad had that yellow shirt, I have the shirt, I just wore it a couple of days ago, but anyways, it has a gorilla on it, right? My dad had that shirt, and so, like, it always tied Real Genius to my dad, and me and my dad watched that movie, and it was like one of the first, like, it's one of possibly the only smart kid movies that feels like a comedy that doesn't feel nerdy. It feels a kind of like Animal House, but it isn't, but it is.
And then the nerds aren't actually just, like, shitty and creepy.
Yeah.
Like, they're actually smart, awkward people. They're very, it is, they're misfits, like. You know, Revenge of the Nerds was hugely popular, and I've used that nerds icon for this podcast. But, like, you watch that movie now, and it's like, oh, these people are, like, for the most part, they're just shitty people. Like, not the jocks. The nerds are kind of shitty people, too. Or not even kind of. Some of them are just outright shitty. So, like, it makes it a little difficult to, because, like, you know, we're not that, or we try not to be that. So it's like, I can't root for these people either. But Real Genius was very true to, like, what that's like.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so, like, anyways, like, I had, like, I spent years looking for that damn, like decades looking for that fucking shirt because I wanted it because it was like my dad threw it away because, you know, like all dads, they have no idea what they have or what something means to you. Right. But my dad still remembers that shirt. Like the funny enough, I told him, I was like, you remember your gorilla shirt? And he's like, oh yeah, the Order of the Gorilla. He's like, I'm like, I found it. And he goes, what? You found, like, why? He's like, how did you find, like, did you find it? Like, if how? I'm like, no. It's like, it's a real shirt from Real Genius. And like, it's a thing. And so finally somebody reprinted it. And so, yeah, I have that shirt that tells you how much, like, that's just tells you how much Real Genius means to me. Like, Real Genius to me is my Goonies. I never was a huge fan of the Goonies. My Revenge of the Nerds and Goonies was Real Genius. Because, I mean, like, that movie goes on, they go on an adventure. They stop, like, instead of them being, like, a bunch of little incel assholes, like, what I love, like, my short pitch to anybody who hasn't seen Real Genius is that, my short pitch is this, is that instead of them being, incel little shits that decide to go with Doge and do stupid shit, they actually stop government assholes from doing asshole things. Like, and it's a really weird, kind of funny, like, it sets up a school year and, but then they're working on this weapon and they don't know it. But then when they find out, rather than going, oh, cool, they go, fuck no, it's science. We're supposed to, like, we thought we were doing it for, like, the betterment of man, not, like, you know, Reaganomics and shit. I really do love that movie. Like, I've watched it twice. It was the first movie I put on. Like, I watched it twice this year. Once just because I randomly wanted to watch it on the Saturday night. You know, like, sometimes you're just in the mood for, like a big movie on a Saturday night that is, like, something that you've seen as comfort food. That's what I did. And then after, it was the first movie I watched after I saw that Kilmer had passed. Because it's, like, you know, it's one of those movies for me.
Yeah. So, for me, those movies became part of Val Kilmer's thing. Like, oh yeah, yeah, I loved him in this. I love Val Kilmer begins for me in Willow.
Yeah, Willow. Oh man.
And I kind of wrote a little something on Facebook. I said this and I kind of stand by it. I mean, it's whatever, but I don't think in the 40 plus years since Willow, there has been another swashbuckling swordsman character that's as lovable as Mad Mardigan.
That tracks. Yeah.
That movie's so underrated. Disney did, they did a disservice with the sequel series. I know what they were trying to do, but it was not good. I hate that nobody can watch it, but also it wasn't good. So it's that thing of, like, nobody will ever discover this, but also it's not very good. So I don't know that anybody wants to discover it. But the original movie is so underrated, and Kilmer's performance is just fucking brilliant.
Really is. Like, you know, like, that's a movie where I know this is going to sound bad. I mean, I have it on Blu-ray because now I'm kind of like kicking my own ass because the Steelbook was like $60. And I refused to pay $60 for a 4K. But now I'm kicking myself in the ass because I'm like, oh, well, I only have the Blu-ray. I would have loved to have had the 4K. And you bet your ass I bought that Tombstone Steelbook as soon as he passed. I was like, fuck it. I'll regret when, like, five years when they haven't brought out another edition of it. So I was just like, fuck it, pull the trigger. But
it's one of those, it's costly, but, like, that's a movie worth having. it's weird. All the stuff that Val Kilmer's done, like, the legacy is going to be two things. One for people they shouldn't hate Batman Forever, and one that people love just across the board almost unconditionally, Tombstone. Like,
yeah,
those two films wind up being his legacy. And I guess that it's kind of fitting, because like Batman Forever, I think is a good movie. I understand why but I enjoyed it. Like I probably saw it 5 times in the theater. Like,
because, well, I mean, like let's be honest, like you and I both grew up on Batman 66 and like Adam West is our first like Batman, and that toes the line of Batman 66 so well. It doesn't Schumacher goes overboard in the next one, but in that one, it toes the line so well.
There is a version of this movie that exists that isn't quite that goofy.
Yes.
That he made, but it's weird how in hindsight you can better understand these things when you understand that, like, oh, Batman Returns was hyped unbelievably by the studio, and they signed this massive deal with McDonald's.
Yep.
And then McDonald's was like, what the fuck is this? We can't sell this to kids. And so Warner Brothers panics for Batman Forever and is like, we can't have any more of this creepy, weird Tim Burton shit.
Yeah.
Like, you've got to make this movie so for kids. Like, we've got to sell this to kids. We got to be able to merchandise the shit out of this. And when you go back and look at it in that light, it's hard to blame the people that got blamed for it. You know? Schumacher and Kilmer, like, and also they famously did not fucking get along with each other, which also made it difficult. I think one of the interviews Schumacher gave about it was, the best thing Val Kilmer ever did for me was say yes to playing Batman, and the second best thing he ever did for me was saying no to playing Batman again. Something like that. I'm probably getting it wrong, but and now they're both gone, and you know, I don't know. Like, I thought what Jim Carrey said about Val Kilmer was incredibly sweet. But yeah, like, for me, it's those three movies, really. Willow, Batman Forever, and Tombstone. Everything That's else cheap. Is, well, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
Yeah, because I was going to say, like, for me, my top three are, like, and I know this sounds, it sounds weird, but it's, like, if I'm really honest with myself, it's The Doors, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, and Real Genius. But that tells you, and look at that work, how varied it is. But, I mean, like, how very varied it is. Like, you and I could say three different movies, and they're all, like, truly amazing performances, but they're very different movies. Like, they're not like same, like they're not a bunch of biopics, or they're not a bunch of dramas. I mean, I'm talking about two comedies and one biopic, one super serious biopic. You're talking about like a fantasy film, a comic book adaptation, and a Western. Like, it's like there's so much, like, and then we didn't even talk about, like, you know, Top Gun. Like, you know, the, like, only Val Kilmer could out, like, out Riz, or, like, you know, out charisma Tom Cruise. And it'd be one of those things where I think that people don't remember that in Top Gun, Tom Cruise loses Top Gun. He doesn't win. It's Val Kilmer's character, Iceman, that wins the whole thing, right? Like, he wins the championship. Like, he wins the contest, right, of Top Gun. But it's Tom Cruise that ends up, proving that he is the Top Gun through the actual battle that they go into.
Yeah.
But, But it's like he wins everything in that movie.
And, you know, you watch that as a kid and you're like, yeah, fuck those guys. And you watch it as an adult and it's kind of like, oh, wait, Tom Cruise is kind of a dick.
Yeah. He's a fucking real
Maverick
asshole.
Is kind of a little asshole, man. Like, yeah. Why are you doing all this stuff, man? Like, why? What? But that's what part of what makes Maverick so enjoyable is that they don't reward that character for being who he is, because when we meet him again in Maverick, he's still doing the same shit he did then. And it's like the recognition of like, oh yeah, he was always in his own way. And so he never got anywhere. Meanwhile, Val Kilmer's character got as far as he could go. So yeah, Val Kilmer's not like the be all end all for, you know, acting wise for me, but like it was just so sad to read that.
Yeah. But because like, and then you go at work, the body of work, and you go, man, this dude was like, for a point, for a time, he was like a star, he was an actor, right? Because he's there's Pacino, De Niro, and then Val Kilmer. Like, that tells you something.
Yeah, he and so Batman big. Forever both came out in 1995. How wild is that?
Seriously, like, and part of the reason why, I was reading something, part of the reason why he got made wasn't because of Pacino and De Niro. That was the thing, Fox, the Warner Brothers of it all, was like they wanted somebody, you know, that, like here's the crazy is like or. Depp, right? And then Johnny Depp and he himself. And at first man didn't want him. And then he realized how much of a shitbuck serious actor this kid was. And like, I don't see anybody but Val Kilmer in that role. Careless, like the guy who he's like he plays. Other than Val, like. And it's kind of thankful because gross shitty movie now at this point if it starred Johnny. And I'm thankful that they, like, for whatever reason, it didn't happen, right? Because I feel like the film is better for it. Like, I mean, again, it's one of those things where it's just like you sit there, you watch the movie and you just go, fuck, this guy is doing it with the greats when they were great. It's not like they're like 80 years old. Like they are now. They were like, you know, Heat is in their prime, right? It's the 30th anniversary of Heat this year because it's 95. Right?
The script for Heat 2 now exists. So,
yes. And you know who's playing, which is so hilarious. It's supposed to be him. Like, who's. Is the guy who looks just. Watch Top Secret. Like, 4K. You can watch it on Paramount Plus. Watch the movie, and I swear to God, you think like he is like Austin Butler currently is the spitting image of 19-year-old Val Kilmer.
Yeah.
Still can't believe it. Like I watched it and was like, this motherfucker looks exactly. That's why they hired him because he looks just fine. So, rest in peace, Val Kilmer. What a fucking career.
Yeah. It bums me out. He didn't really. I mean, he did go out on top. Maverick made a shit ton of money, but I don't know. It's just sad to think that. But I mean, I guess whoever really does go out on top, Heath Ledger, you know, because he died when he was freaking 30. So,
and even then, that's even sadder because, you know, think about all the like, you know. Transpose like Heath Ledger's career and have him having a Val Kilmer type of career.
Yeah.
Like, imagine that. Like, because that's the kind of thing that you probably would have gotten out of out of Heath Ledger, is that he never would have been the traditional movie star, right? No, he would have always kind of transitioned back and forth. He would have won another Oscar. He should have had two Oscars in his career. But, like, you know.
Oh, so Kilmer.
Yeah. Kilmer should probably have. He should, yeah, he should at least have two. He should have one for The Doors and one for Tombstone.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Because Tombstone is the great robbed performance. Like, you know, like, literally you watch that. If you, like, performance-wise for me, at the end of the day, even though it's not my favorite Kilmer movie, like, the performance, it's got to be neck and neck with Tombstone and The Doors and Jim Morrison. It's kind of weird that he, like, his two best performances that, like, are like real life people and not like not characters that he created, but like real people that he inhabited.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but,
I just looked up who won the best supporting actor in 1994, which would have been for 1993, which Tombstone was 93, right?
Yeah, 93.
Yeah, it was Tommy Lee Jones for The Fugitive.
Oh, fuck.
It's good. I don't think it's as good as Kilmer in Tombstone, though.
No, but the shittier part is that he's not even nominated.
Yeah. Not to get into the Tombstone of it all, but I think there was a lot of that movie had two directors, like the studio had to replace the director, and I think there was a lot of like inside baseball shit in that movie that kind of kept, you know, like those Hollywood types from kind of really embracing it the way they probably should have.
Absolutely. Well, and you redirected.
Yeah.
Because, like, he's never. We'll never get. I'm not gonna talk about it. Reason why the other guy was George. Models were brought on, and all of there's a lot of like the making of Tombstone. Like, there's an actual book. Like, it's a great, like, weird account. It's very, very weird. Was that there was one person set that was actually directing everything, and that was Kurt Russell.
Yeah,
like the studio did not. That you cannot have an actor who's also a producer take over the directing reins. That's actually the Sylvester Stallone rule. Did you know that motherfucker? So many directors.
Yeah.
That created a rule that you could not do that. Did that? DGA from him. Like, that's the kind of like egomaniac fucking. Yeah, there's this amazing Tombstone. That's like true, like, vision of what they expect wanted it to be. But yeah, you're right. Like, with all of the weird, like the Charles production, actually. Get any kind of nominations because, you know, what's this blood of water, there's blood, right?
Yeah.
So, but yeah. Yeah, man. You look back on it, like, that's kind of like, that's one of those ones that's a true tragedy because we should have had more work from him. But yeah. Health problems.
Yeah. And, I mean, he did get to do what he loved for a really long time. So,
yes.
Something he was truly passionate about. So I think there's, I don't know if you can really see it, but I want to say there was like a film version of the Mark Twain stage stuff.
There is. He used to tell it when he would when he did like when he show he actually went out and like he would like he would talk all of the goods and the wares as Mark Twain, and one of the things was the DVD, which he would sign. So like, you know, just one of those like weird affectations of everything, which is kind of great, right? Like, you know, especially when somebody's like pot committed to something like that. Yeah. So yeah, I wonder if there's something that we'll probably go on YouTube and watch it. You know, if there's not a sellable version or an actual.
Yeah, I think it's Cinema Twain, because the play was Citizen Twain. So that sucked to lose him. So I filled the rest of my week basically just catching up on all the stuff I've watched generally. But I did start a new show. That I just wanted to briefly bring up to say, yeah, if I'll you're interested in watching this, maybe don't watch it. It's not terrible, but there's a new show on Hulu called Mid-Century Modern. Stars Nathan Lane. It's supposed to be a kind of sort of updated version of Golden Girls, which I was a big fan of, but it's just not very good.
We've been watching it when we need a palate cleanser. Because it's so bad, but you kind of like, it's like a car crash where you kind of have to, it's Nathan Lane and Matt Boomer. I'm like, how the fuck did you get these guys to do this and these screenplays? Because it's like, it's literally like if gay men, like the whole concept is like three gay men in Palm Springs decide to live together and wacky hijinks ensue. But it feels like it's written by a bunch of white guys in the 1980s, because it's so fucking crass about like everything. And maybe that's the concept, right? Maybe that's what they all loved about it. Oh, we get to do like, you know, the basis common denominator jokes. But I mean, it's like still it's like.
But there's like every once in a while, there's a really good moment or really funny scene. But like overall, I haven't got to him yet. I made it three episodes in.
You started and you're like, oh no.
I made it to I think the fourth episode. I fell asleep. Episode is the where you Matt Bomer meets his daughter
Billy,
which is a really. Really sweet scene. It's very well done. But, like, there's a bunch of, like, airplane humor stuff surrounding it. Like, some of it's stupid. I thought I thought she was really funny. I thought that was hysterical. But, like, everything else is just not great. It's like 4 minutes of like really good stuff from people you know that can do really good stuff, and then like 16 minutes of like, this is bad jokes.
Yeah, it like you're almost embarrassed for everybody, but you see what they were trying to do. It's just the writers are just, I don't know, man.
It's James Burrows. Like, this is a guy that, I mean, was fucking the guy in like the 80s and 90s, right?
Like, maybe he just stayed in the 80s and 90s. Yeah, I mean, that part, you know, it's not like, you know, it's like it, like we often talked about what's his name, who's like 150 years old now and he's still doing it, Norman Lear. you know, and his one day at a time is, yeah, like, and like, you know, doing it in a way that like is dangerous, but maybe not everybody can be Norman Lear. I mean, yeah. You know, like, it's also Ryan Murphy, which I'm very surprised that Ryan Murphy produces this. I know why he produces the show, because Matt Boomer, right? We know that they're friends and stuff, and they have like both a personal and working relationship, and it's Nathan Lane also, but it just, like, the quality, like, you expect it. I expected it to be more, and it's not. And yeah. It's like, oh, okay. Well, who knows? Maybe in the second season, they'll get their bearings. If they get a second season with this cast, I don't imagine, like, if they don't want to do it, or if they want to do it, which is kind of like, you know, they'll be able to get at least a second season out of it. Maybe they'll figure it out and get a new writer's room, and it'll be a snappier kind of thing. Because I expected it to be snappier. Like, do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I expected it to be like, oh,
that's what I thought. Like, that's Golden Girls is pretty snappy, man. Like,
yes, it is.
That show is fucking rapid fire shit. Like, yeah. And this moves kind of at a snail's pace. Joke. Yeah. It's like they say the joke and then wait for the laugh. Like, Golden Girls, man, sometimes it's like fucking gunfire the way they're firing off those jokes. And they are mean sometimes.
Oh, like, yes.
Or not even sometimes. Most of the time, they're mean. And, like, so Matt Bomer's basically playing Rose.
Yes.
And we all loved Rose, but she was dumb. And Matt Bomer's playing dumb. Nobody on that show ever had a problem firing off at Rose about her ridiculous stories or how dumb they thought she was. Now, is it mean? Yeah. But it was funny. And it was funnier when she stood up for herself or clapped back at them. And you don't have that here. Like, it's more of the, like, oh, poor himbo, because that's what Matt Bomer's playing, you know?
Exactly.
And it's just, I don't know. It's lacking something. And I like Matt Bomer. I don't think he's very good here, though. Like, I think he's miscast as the dumb one. So yeah. I get what stereotype you're playing on, but I just don't think he's pulling it off. So, I don't know. We'll see. It's definitely lacking something. If they do more, I may, you know, it's not something I'm like, oh, I've got to like burn through all of this. I'm enjoying it so much. You know, it'll probably become like a background show just so I can get it, you know, finished out of my queue or whatever. But, but yeah, I that was the new show that I checked out this week. And I was just like, this is not good. Like, I watched 3.5 episodes. I thought I was through most of the series. I was like, oh, I've only watched 3 episodes.
Yeah, it's not great stuff. Yeah, like, definitely not. I actually got out to the theaters. I snuck out to the theaters to watch something. And it was actually very good. No, that's tonight. That's tonight. I will see that. So I went to go see Black Bag, the Soderbergh spy movie.
Yeah.
And
I've heard it's good.
It plays, man. It's one of the best movies of the year so far. I really enjoyed the shit out of it. 90 minutes, tight, compact. And I did not know, like, color me surprised that, like, Soderbergh can continually surprise me and making a movie that's pro-marriage. Like, it's a spy movie about a married spy couple, and it's not about how they're duplicitous against one another, that they're always on each other's side. And that's, like, the whole moral of the story, is, like, you know, don't fuck with married couples that love each other. Like, it's a great little fucking compact movie. I loved it. It was funny. It was kind of sexy. It was surprising because it had a fair decent amount of twists and turns. And like I said, very, very compact at 90 minutes. You can't ask for anything more. And like watching it on the big screen, it was kind of nice. I'd forgotten that I like those kinds of movies in the big screen. So yeah, on a Tuesday, I just kind of, a Tuesday afternoon, it was 3 o'clock. I'm off at 2. I was like, fuck it. I was like, I bought my ticket in advance. I went to go see it. And you know what I forgot about? AMC does this whole thing about discount Tuesdays where everything before 5 o'clock is like super discounted. And I had a packed house of a bunch of oldies, like a bunch of older people, like over the age of like 60. And I will tell you, this movie worked on them huge. Like they were actually a little rowdy. I was surprised. They were laughing. They were cheering. It was genuinely shocking. You'd think that this movie was a blockbuster. I mean, it's not. It's kind of made a little bit of money, but not much. So yeah, I went to go see that. I was genuinely, I love Soderbergh, right? Like he's the dude, he's become the king of the 90-minute genre movie. Like whenever he wants to make a movie, he's like, oh, I'll make a 90-minute movie. And like Presence is another one that I saw, I snuck out to the theaters to see, and it was just like, it was a solid 90-minute like Poltergeist movie. Like with a clever twist on it. So yeah, like I definitely recommend it. It's on Premiere VOD, but whenever it comes to Peacock, everybody's favorite, watch it. Like because it's a Universal movie, so it'll be on Peacock. It'll probably be on Peacock in like a month or two. So
I
like
in May when it literally had like a week window of like, hey, it's in theaters. Hey, it's on VOD.
I went to go see like I saw it because I saw it drop on Tuesday on Premiere VOD. And I was like, $24? Are you fucking kidding me? No, that's what I paid for a month of AMC. Yeah, I'm going to go to AMC and see it shit. I'm going to go see that. I'll get myself a nice soda. I'll get myself some popcorn, which I did. And I enjoyed the shit out of it. I went to see that. And then... We'll talk about something. I caught up on the studio, and we're going to be talking about that in a little bit. But I wanted to tell you, so we're big fans. Like, you would think that we're like, I've always deplored dating shows and stupid competition shows, but oddly enough, I watch a fair decent amount of them, right? I watch a lot of cooking shows and cooking competitions, and I do watch this year alone, I've watched two, they're not dating shows, but they are. Like I told you about the Muslim matchmaker one that I enjoyed the shit out of. But another one that we constantly watch is back, Love on the Spectrum. We like the new episode, the season 3 just dropped, and so we started watching it. And man, if you need a dose of like just reaffirming life, like life affirming, like life goes on, life is good. Like the best of us can, like, you know, there is hope. Watch Love on the Spectrum. Like, honestly, the short pitch is, it's about, young men and women that are, that have an autism diagnosis, different spectrums of autism, and how they're looking for love. And how they go on dates, and some of them like actually find love and some don't, but they continue to move on, and you get to learn about their families. Some of whom still take care of them. Some of them who are on their own and independent, but like, you know, still have a helping hand with their families. And it's just, I don't know if you've ever seen Logan, but it is.
I've seen enough to know, like, to get the idea of it. It's one of those shows where, like, I think if I watched it, I would love it, but I would also be a wreck watching it.
You're not a wreck as much as you think you are, because it's so pleasant. I mean, there are moments where you definitely get teared up, especially with the families, because you're not sure what you're expecting from some of these families. But then when you see that they see their children growing in ways that they didn't expect, that's where it hits you. That's like they only have those few moments because they know that those are special moments, and they only happen very rarely. They don't force. The wonderful thing about Love on the Spectrum is they never force anything. they always just allow life to happen. And like this season is like, you know, just like the last two seasons and then the ones that were in Australia. There's a total, I think, of six seasons. The first three are in Australia because that's where it started. And then they transposed it to America. And so they have them, three American versions of them. And it's just, it's the best way I can describe it is that after the dumpster fire of a fucking week we've had, like sitting here and watching like five episodes over the last 3 days or 2 days has been a godsend. Because it makes me instantly forget about the dumpster fire shitstorm that diarrhea mouth has caused. And we're just like, you know, there's these kids that are out there trying to just like, it makes you recontextualize everything. And it's just like, these kids are like finding love and losing love. And like, they're growing more than just finding love. These kids are growing. I mean, they're literally growing. And it's like I would recommend it to anybody that doesn't know anyone that has an autism diagnosis, because it will educate you on what your assumptions are and how wrong they are. And it's just, like I said, it's a very lovely show. It's one of those things where you can put on, and even if you had a bad day, you're like, it's like a labradoodle, or it's like a golden retriever, or a Labrador. Like, you come home and you see them and their stupid faces and their stupid acts, you can't help but smile, right? Like, it's like any dog. And I hate to use that comparison, but it's the only way I can, like, it's the only thing that I can kind of equate it to, where it's like instantly feel better about the world and the state of the world because there are these people in them. And it's a little awkward, but like my wife says, like, she's like, you know, I watch this show and my cheeks hurt because I'm smiling so much, because, you know, it's just a wonderful, lovely piece of like, it's just a lovely piece of the world. And you kind of just like, you wish that more people would watch this shit, because like, you know, you can't be mad at kids just trying to find their way and, you know, not knowing, like I think like my favorite part about it is like the misconception I had was that, like, you know, somebody with an autism diagnosis doesn't know that they have the diagnosis and doesn't know the things that they're doing, but they absolutely do. And that's the most wonderful thing about it, is there's this quality of like, they're constantly challenging you as much as they're challenging themselves, even if they don't know that they're challenging themselves. It's great. Like, it's really great. And I recommend it to anybody. There's, like I said, there's like literally, they're hour long episodes. So you have like literally, like you have 10 episodes. Like, you have like literally, I don't know, 60 to 70 hours of just pure unadulterated awesomeness in store for you if you decide to dive in.
Yeah. I mean, it's one that's been on my, I should check that out for, you know, a very long while. But yeah, like, I always just assume like, oh, this is going to be one of those shows that, like, I watch and every episode I just wind up crying. So,
it would be definitely a good, it would be a definitely a good puzzle show. Like, I know you love to build puzzles. I think that it would definitely be something that you would, you could do with a puzzle. Like, you know, it's one of those things.
We're about to talk about the studio. Apple also dropped all four episodes of Side Quest, and I've talked a lot about Mythic Quest, but this is a spinoff show. It's just four episodes. I did watch that. The first episode is really good. The other three episodes are okay. It's got a good idea behind it, which is like expanding the world of Mythic Quest is mostly dealing with people making the game, and this tries to expand it to people who are kind of influenced by the game or who play the game. But the problem is, outside of the first episode, every episode is introducing you to brand new characters and dropping you into a completely new world. So you don't really get to spend time with anybody. And it comes off feeling a little like they're good. It's just like, oh, this is a 30-minute story about somebody I'm probably never going to see again. In a world that I really enjoy. So, and I may be wrong. Like, maybe we get to the next season of Mythic Quest, which also had its finale recently, and was great. I don't know. There is one episode that takes place in a comic book store, and it's about the Mythic Quest comic book, or about people wanting the Mythic Quest comic book. And it does feature our favorite television janitor.
That's interesting.
And who also had, like, are you caught up on
yes, Abbott? I am. Did Jill Scott it all?
Yeah, that Jill Scott thing was pretty wild. I was like, man, they are, like, going full on with this dude. Like, oh, no, he's creepy. He's really, really good in the Mythic Quest episode. He plays a guy who just hangs out at this comic book shop and plays magic all day. Pretty funny.
That's hilarious.
I watched that too. But more importantly, on Apple Plus, we both watched The Studio, which has three episodes as of right now. And I think every freaking body should be watching this show because it's fucking brilliant. I know I kind of talked it up last week and you were like, yeah, I was going to watch it, but you know, I was kind of just, you know, like waiting to see. And I kind of twisted your arm into watching it. And so what did you think?
It's brilliant. Like, it is probably the best thing on TV right now. Like hands down, like not even like close. Like, I was worried about the cringe, but the cringe is what makes it so good.
You see what, like, I mean? It's like, it is cringy, but it's cringy against people that you're like, I don't care how awkward this is for these people, because you're not ever going to be, not in a shitty way, but like, we're never going to be in that position. You or I are never going to be the head of a studio. We're never going to be, like, having to have these conversations. So you kind of get to enjoy them being put in awkward situations.
Oh, absolutely. The ringer that Seth Rogen's Matt Rimmick goes through, at the hands of in every single episode, to me is like comedic gold. Like, it's like one of those things where I go, I don't give a fuck about this guy. Like,
episode, you really are, like, in the first like 5 minutes, you're like really with this guy, and then you see him be the absolute prototypical Hollywood piece of shit. Like, he goes from, like, you're like, man, like, he's gonna get his moment, he's like bided his time, and like, he's gonna do things, and then, like, immediately when he's in front of who I can only imagine is their version of David Zaslav, Bryan Cranston's character,
I have to stop this for a moment, playing a character named Griffin Mill. So this is how good Rogan and Goldberg are, is that Griffin Mill is this, who is the character that what's his name from Jesus Christ, I can't think of his name, I just dropped his name now, from The Player, the main character from The Player, Robert Altman's Hollywood movie.
Oh, yeah.
who eventually becomes the studio head in the movie, The Player. Oh God, what's his name? Tim Robbins. Tim Robbins' character in The Player is named Griffin Mill. So, like, it's like, like, but that's just the way that the studio, the show works. It's got, it's so metatextual. It has references upon references inside of references, right? Like, which we'll get into a little bit more, but like Bryan Cranston playing the literally the shittiest version of like what you expect David Zasloff to be.
Yeah.
But perfection.
Immediately, right? I was like, holy shit. I was like, Adam has got to watch this. This is so insane. Like, we're making the Kool-Aid
movie. Oh, which I love, like, so, like, there's a cleverness to the scripts that, like, you're just not expecting because of the way that how you think it's going to be one thing, right? Like, because, like, you're like, oh, shit, like, he's going to have to do the Kool-Aid movie. And then, you know, of course, like, he has the Nick Stoller, like, you know, they have the cameo from director Nick Stoller. And he does the pitch exactly the way that you would expect the studio to do it, right?
And he's like... and it's not a bad pitch. It's no, stupid. It's not. But it's not a bad pitch.
Yeah. It's very of the era. It's very, like, it's hilarious that that is being made at the same time that we're getting a Minecraft movie, because it's so kind of like I can only imagine that Apple and Goldberg and Rogan were like, we are already making this. Let's make it around this time because this fucking movie is coming out. But my favorite part is you instantly know when Martin Scorsese pitches his Jonestown master.
You have the same light bulb that Seth Rogen has. You're like, oh, fuck. Like, yeah. This is the Kool-Aid movie.
This is the Kool-Aid movie. And then it goes so fucking sideways. It's exactly what you expect to happen, right? And then it does the thing. Like, what I love about that first episode is that it does the thing that you don't expect it to do, which is he fucks Martin Scorsese. Like,
for his job, he fucks over Martin Scorsese.
Yeah, because it is his job to do it. I mean, even, like, so, like, the one of my favorite roles one of my favorite characters is Catherine O'Hara, because she is both the worst influence and the best influence.
Yeah.
Because she's fucking him over.
Do you think she's, is this, like, Amy Pascal kind of thing?
I think it is.
That feels like the analog there. Because, like, she winds up with a deal at the studio that fired her.
Yes.
And that's what happened with Amy Pascal.
And also, like Rogan was super close to Amy Pascal. She gave him his directing career. Like, she was the one, like, the interview? Their first movie? Which, yeah. Okay, can we just stop and appreciate that their first movie almost ruined them because of North Korea and because of the emails, but they still managed to have a career, and not just a, like, we're going to talk about this in a second, but a career that I feel like not just to comedians, but anybody would want. Like, their output, and we'll talk about that in a bit, like, is supremely, like, beyond just comedic work, like, just general genre work is, like, fucking wild.
I gotta correct you. This Is the End was actually his first movie as a director. Oh, the Interview was his second movie.
That's true. That's right. That's right.
They were literally on top of each other.
But, yeah, that's right.
This Is the End came out first. And This Is the End was, I mean, kind of a moderate, kind of underground hit, but, like, yeah, you follow it up with The Interview, and then, yeah, it almost fucking ruined your career, at least as a director. They had done, writing Superbad was probably their first script.
Yeah, Superbad was the first, he helped, like, I know that he helped with 40-Year-Old Virgin, and then Knocked Up was him and Apatow, but their first, produced and they wrote the script was Superbad, which, like, you know, 25 years later is still it's a classic. Many people consider it a true classic of comedy. which I do not like. I won't put that down. I won't argue with that. But like back to the studio, like they fuck Martin's. Like, I mean, like it's so funny to watch like Catherine O'Hara give him advice that you can absolutely tell is both helpful and like is obvious, but it feels so just kind of like, oh, she, you don't realize how like she is not your mentor right now and she's not doing you a service.
Yeah.
But like the way that like the way that he like he literally kills Martin Scorsese's baby and then Martin Scorsese figures it out, but then how it all turns because Griffin is like, oh, you bought it, you spent the $10 million so there could never be a Kool-Aid movie, I like you, kid. And yeah, then him realizing what he had done, like the fact that he unintentionally did something so vicious, like probably the most vicious thing, like, and then of course the cameo of Charlize Theron, which, like, have you seen their movie together?
I don't think so.
They did a rom com together that he wrote again, of course, because you know, God damn it, what is it called? It's actually really great. I really like it. It like leads up to them actually having a, like an actual relationship. It's God damn it, what is it called?
I'll look it up.
Yeah, I'm gonna look it up too. Long Shot.
I haven't seen it.
Oh, dude, you need to see it. Like, this is actually a really fun rom-com where he plays a journalist and she was his babysitter and now she's running for the president of the United States. It's actually not, he didn't actually write it. Dan Sterling and Liz Hannah wrote it. Liz Hannah, you would know from The Post and the other the Ruffalo movie. We knew that they knew that they did it. They knew that they did it. They won all the Oscars. This movie
came out in 2019.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I don't think I've ever even heard of it.
Oh, dude, you're going to, this is a treat. This is actually a real treat. Like,
why? I have to watch it with Stephanie.
We're
always looking for. I finally have somebody to watch movies with. You know, for the longest time, it's like I'm not going to the theater by myself, and now she's all in on watching movies together. Okay. But yeah, so which we did watch one, and I'll bring it up there. Then I didn't want to waste a lot of time talking about Odessa. The first one, the promotion is the episode and becoming, but then you have the second episode, which I was like, I don't know, like they're like, I was the first episode, I was so high on this. The second episode, I was like, I don't know how they did this. I don't know how the fuck they did this.
And they directed it like, and it's like such a meta weird commentary, but also not a commentary, but also it is. It's such smart filmmaking. Like The Wonder, where like, you know, like I just love it. Like Sarah Pauley's directing an LGBTQ movie starring Greta Lee, and they're trying to get the one shot done. And Matt, like they're trying to stop Matt from coming on the set, but he goes and he just fucks everything up. And
the way they bring it back to the fucking car.
Yeah.
I was talk about a lost myself.
Oh my God. That and the fact that they actually paid the money. Like it's the whole concept of like everything that happens in that episode, it replays itself in the episode itself as a motif. And when it drops the "you can't always get what you want" over the scene. Man, I just about fucking died, dude. And
they're driving away against the call. They didn't get the shot. Fuck.
Fuck. I love that in the best way possible, like, you hate him. You hate, like, Matt is, like in three episodes, Matt is quickly becoming the new Michael Scott of the TV world.
Yeah.
But in a way that Michael Scott was always unlikable and always cringe, but there's something that Rogan has done. And you were talking about like how this is like you, we talked offline about how this is the best thing. This could possibly at the end of the day, be the best thing that Seth Rogen will ever do.
Acting wise, for sure. Yeah. The best thing he's ever done.
Because at the end of the day, you like they're, bits, there's fits and starts where I fucking hate Michael Scott so much in that show that I stopped watching it.
Yeah.
There's nothing that,
especially early on. It's just I can't deal with this guy, man. You know, and
go ahead.
Like, it's not quite there with Matt. Like, not quite there. But, like, the third episode definitely doesn't. Like, it kind of gets you there, but, like, I don't know. That third episode was also just flat-out brilliant and was such a great commentary on how people can't get out of their own way. Even people like Ron Howard.
Man. Like, okay, so Alphabet City is, like, okay, so, like, this is the test for any behind the scenes like Hollywood thing is if you can hook me, like for me at least, if you can show me a movie within a movie and I go, fuck, I want to see that.
I want to see that movie.
I want to see Alphabet City. Like, and it seems like a movie that Ron Howard would do, right? Yeah. Like, and it has a cast that Ron Howard would cast. Like, he would cast Mackie and Franco. Dave, not the other troubling asshole. Let's be clear about that. It is wild, like, that they understand all of the bits. Like, in a weird way, I feel like Rogan and Goldberg are still, like, you said something, and then it really kind of solidified what I love about their career, is that there's no ego there. They are still, like, one of us, right? Like, they are still the 20-year-old kids that are looking at one another saying, fuck, we get to write this kind of shit? Are you fucking kidding? We're writing a Ninja Turtles movie. What the fuck? How did we do this? And we get to make our Ninja Turtles movie with fucking Ice Cube, with fucking Nine Inch Nails doing our score.
I think that's part of why, like, you watch these three episodes and you're like, how are these people showing up for, like, 2.5 minutes? Like,
yeah.
In some cases, not even that long. But, you know, even people like Steve Buscemi's always down to do just about any fucking thing. Yeah. Like, he's such a nice guy, and, like, he'll show up for whatever, you know. Yeah. But, like, this kind of thing is just like you got Scorsese to come in and play, like, kind of a soft version of himself. But then you get Ron Howard to come in and play this hard-ass version of himself. You know, like, Howard's, notoriously, like, the Tom Hanks level of, like, nicest guy in Hollywood, you know? Yeah. And Scorsese, not that he's not nice, but, like, he's not, like, they play him so... Like, he starts crying about his movie being shelved, which, you know, I can see, but, like, it's just the willingness to play up these types that go against who you think these people are, and just getting them to come play for sometimes literally seconds of screen time speaks volumes to who they are, probably, as just people. Like, they're obviously not difficult to work with. And they don't treat people like shit, probably, because everybody just seems down to play for whatever length of time.
They're Canadian. I mean, like, I feel like that kind of says a lot about them, like Goldberg and Rogan. Rogan and Goldberg, is they're Canadian. But also, like, the wildest thing to me is that both of them got started so young. I mean, Rogan was 16 when he did when like the 1-2 combo of Freaks and Geeks and your favorite Donnie Darko. Yeah. He was 16. I mean, he was 16 looking like he was 42.
Yeah, he always looked older.
Yeah, I find it hilarious that he's like he's aged in. I mean, he's younger than us, right? Like, I think he's like 39 right now at this point, and he's had a 20-year career, right, already. And like, but like, you watch this, you watch this show, and it's like,
I know he's 43. He is younger than us, but he's 43. Yeah.
But he just like slightly younger than us. I mean, yeah, he's still within our generation, right? Like, so much so that like his shit is extremely our shit, right? Like, you know, The Boys, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Mutant Mayhem.
We grew up on the same shit. We, you know, yeah.
We like the same shit. Like, you know, like it's like Preacher. Like, you know, it's like there's all this stuff. But I feel like the studio is like their, like it's a commingling of everything, right? They're getting to do things that they probably will never get to do again. Like Alphabet City is their crime film. And I mean, like I looked it up, they directed it, right? They directed it to make it look like a Ron Howard crime film from the 70s. And like you said, Dave Franco shows up for like three scenes in that, like he shows up for like all of a minute in that that episode, right? He's not even a part of the actual
show. Yeah, it's a movie within the show.
Exactly. But then you get Mackie, who, like, when would you ever have a chance to, like, when would they ever have a chance to work with Mackie? Because they kind of already made fun of Mackie, like, a Mackie-like figure in The Boys, right? Like, I mean, we all know where, like, you know, like, where that character is from, right? I mean, very much so, like we even watch, like, you know, we watch Captain America, and now we absolutely know, like, the fucking fuckery that's happened with him. But Mackie comes and he's so game. He is so like he gave me the biggest laugh is when he comes in and he's like, yeah, so you know, Ron's over there and da 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 da, and then when they finally reveal like the 45-minute section of the motel scene, and yeah, he goes, thank fucking God, you need to fucking do this. You need to tell him. I'm not the fucking studio head. You're the studio head.
Yeah.
Like, wow. Like, just like he, like just that role and the ability, like also the other funny part is like he's like when Howard starts retelling the story of the beautiful mind screening.
Oh yeah.
Because he finally remembers. And then Mackie's like, that shit's pretty funny, man. You got to admit. Oh man. Like he, like him being able to subvert his persona and his image of what we think of Anthony Mackie, and he like comes to play, like Jesus Christ, dude, that's so good. Like it's like, how do you even think about, like, how do you think that your choice is Anthony Mackie? Like, who, like is this, it, like, I would feel like that's like your first choice, right? But how do you come to that? Like, how do you know that he's going to come to play? How do you know that it's going to be funny? Is it like interactions with him? Like he goes, oh, I fucking saw fucking The Boys. I know what you're fucking doing. Call me up. We'll fucking work together. Something like that. And then you just keep it in your head. You know, because it's so unexpected how funny he is, right? Like, at least to me, like there's charming, but there's like a difference between charming and being actually fucking funny and hitting those lines that you know are funny.
Yeah.
Like the way Catherine Hahn and Ike Bernholtz are funny in this show. Like, I don't know what fucking universe they're directing Catherine Hahn from, but like, it's almost like she's trying to do Catherine O'Hara circa 1988, but just transposing it to 2025. And I'm here for it, right? Like Catherine Hahn, like every time she shows up in a new outfit, I'm like, what the fuck is going on here? Who is she?
Yeah, I the show just kills every second. It's edited pitch perfectly. Like,
yeah,
it moves. Like, I just talked about a show that there's these like weird pauses for laughter, and like this show is so rapid, and the music. just builds and builds and builds and builds and like does what music is supposed to do in these types of things. Like it moves your emotions. In this case, it amps your anxiety.
Yes. No, very much so. Like it's got that like score and kind of tone of the best way I can put it is Magnolia, like Paul Thomas Anderson's Magnolia, which is like anxiety personified for me. Because they even managed to make single one shots. There's a lot of tracking shots in the show, right? But the tracking shots are so kind of nervy and anxiety provoking. And it reminds me a lot of the way that Magnolia is directed. If you watch Magnolia, it's a lot of tracking shots, but it's also got that persistent score, that needling score that the studio has. Like there's that, like that discordant, like weird needling thing that it does that amps up your anxiety, but it's not really, for me, it's not a super 100% anxiety because it adds to the comedy of it.
Yeah.
Like for me, it like builds on the comedy. Like it's weird because it's like there's this tension there, right? Like especially with this last episode where they're going back and forth between the rooms, but it keeps on getting funnier. Because like it just piles on, and then finally he has to do his thing, and then when like you know that it's coming, especially after Ron Howard, like the curtain opens and Ron Howard reveals himself to be an asshole, you're like, oh, it's only a matter of time.
But everybody else, like the first few minutes is talking about what he's the nicest guy. Like, of course he'll take the note. Like, it'll be fine. And then, but he knows because he's seen that version of Ron Howard. He's like, no, you guys don't understand. He's actually mean. He's a really mean guy.
And my favorite part is like everybody I respected was there. Spielberg, the Coens, and then he remember, like the best part is Ron Howard remembers everything because he's like, here's this fucking guy in front of fucking Spielberg, in front of the fucking Joel and Ethan Coen. And it's just, it's perfect comedy. It's like they were building up stories. Cause I almost imagine that something like this happened to Rogan with a filmmaker. We will probably never find out. We'll never find out unless Rogan is like, hey, you know what? I got invited to this screening of this movie. And then it all went to shit because I like at 21,
because I made a stupid suggestion because I thought that
because I was 21 years old.
Yeah.
I fucking knew my shit. And I could never work with that person again.
Because is a stupid note. Like the note on A Beautiful Mind is dumb. Like, it's like, did you see the movie? Like, no, that doesn't make any sense. But you know, this note is like, this 45 minutes is like the time jump at the beginning as they're watching the movie is so perfect. You know, 25 minutes later, 90 minutes later, like, oh God, this is brilliant. And they're sending them 45 minutes later, like, what the fuck was that?
But what I love is that, again, the show turns on itself and it does the exact thing, but for 45 seconds instead of 45 minutes.
Yeah.
And Matt is sitting there and he's looking at his reflection in the pool, and then he goes upstairs and he looks up at the thing, and then it ends so perfectly where you go like with the perfect last line, because it's like they forgive each other, and you know, they like, you know, he's going to cut it, right? Like he's going to cut the 45 minutes, but then he adds into the thing and he's like, don't you ever fucking cross me again. And it's like, you can't help but laugh at the entirety of it. Like it's just the way that they're able to turn episodes in on themselves and make this the thing is brilliant.
It's like, so smart. It is so smart. And it's just like, these are the guys that, I mean, should be doing things. Like this is, I don't know how they're doing as much as they're doing, but I mean, They're just firing on all cylinders right now, man.
Yeah, they really are. I mean, we were just talking about their output, like, you know, what they were doing, like just currently what they're doing. And it's like, wow, okay. But also, like, if you think about it, like, he's not really doing a lot of film roles, right? Like, he's not doing like starring roles anymore. The biggest thing that the biggest thing that he's done recently is Lion King. He came back for the Mufasa movie. I haven't seen it. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, which is that and Donkey Kong he's done animated stuff, right? Like, he hasn't done a lot of starring roles or even co-starring. I know that he has the Keanu Reeves Aziz Ansari directorial movie. You know which one I'm talking about, right? Good Fortune or whatever. Yeah. The one where they had to completely redo it because Ansari and Bill Murray came to blows, to which, you know, I'll just leave you guys to look at and download that particular story and the reason why Bill Murray is a fucking asshole for that. But anywho, but I mean, he's doing more producing, directing, and writing, which, you know, allows him to not have to do a lot of his acting work is, I guess it appears like is more voice work, know, because he does do a voice in Invincible, so you know there's that.
Alan the Alien is so great, man.
Oh my god, yes, he is so good. He really is. He's that's a lot easier to do to produce because I was looking it up. The studio is their first, Goldberg and Rogan it's their first, from the beginning to the end, they're directing the entire series.
Yeah.
So it's their first thing that they've done in a while that it wasn't just a premiere or a first episode or something like that. So, I think that it's possible that he's doing all of this stuff because, you know, he's not really doing a lot of acting, which takes up most of the time. Right.
Oh yeah.
So,
yeah.
So
it's just across the board. It's just great. But
yeah,
he's acting wise. He's just so good in this that, you know, it kind of makes me a little sad. I'm like, oh shit, he could have had a real, not Seth Rogen goofy acting career. He could have had a real acting career.
So the thing I think, my theory on this is, I think the studio was inspired by his work with Spielberg in The Fablemans. Because if you watch, have you watched The Fablemans?
No, I haven't seen it.
You got to see it. First, just because it's Spielberg, but second, Rogan is so good, and he plays a very specific role, and I don't want to ruin it because it's not a twist, because if you know Spielberg's history and you know, because he's making the movie about himself, right? He's making his autobiography. But the way that he is able to remain a likable person in the show, in the movie, but still be despicable, is a lot of what feels like is the studio. It's the groundwork. It's he had to crawl in Fablemans and be directed by Spielberg to understand how to do it in order to get to the studio. Because also the other thing is the studio really does feel like, it's weird, but I feel like the studio and the way that it's directed feels very middle career Spielberg. Do you know what I mean? It feels also like middle career P.T. Anderson too, because they're both kind of one and the same if you really watch, because they're all just kind of doing from John Ford. But it really feels like that, because it's like, it's that serious work that Spielberg did. But if you watch it and you really concentrate on it, it really does feel like that. And I don't know, I feel like maybe he kind of got his shit together. Like, this feels like different Rogan. But if you watch the Fablemans, this is like, Fablemans feels like the Rosetta Stone to get us to this point, to where it's like, oh, he's leading man. He's not trying to be jokey about, he's being jokey, but he's not winking at the camera, I guess, is my thing. Is that, yeah, I always feel like he's always kind of winking, but not, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, like even in Steve Jobs, where he's playing Wozniak, like there's this moment where he backs down in Wozniak. Like, what I don't like about the Jobs movie is that there's the confrontation between him and Fassbender as Jobs. And there's a moment, you can actually tell the moment where Rogan backs down from Fassbender. And maybe that's a note that they gave, Boyle gave him. And maybe that was written in the Sorkin script. But it's the thing where I'm like, no, Wozniak would never back down from Jobs. He was the one guy that was like, fuck you, I'm out of here. I hate you. You're a fucking piece of shit. I'm going to go and play my guitar and own the Portland Trailblazers because you're such a fucking cocksucker. And it doesn't happen. Like, there's this like backing off moment. It almost feels like Rogan didn't feel like he could do it, right? Like he could pull it off. But anyway, yeah. This is like a different kind of Seth Rogen. Like if he gets an Emmy for this, I would not be surprised, right? Like, you know, hell, maybe this is the first time that the Bear doesn't win like, you know, comedic comedy when it should.
Yeah, it shouldn't be in comedy.
Yeah. But maybe it's the first time where Jeremy Allen White doesn't win best actor in a comedy. Yeah.
I hope so. I can only hope so, because unless this show takes a huge fucking nosedive in the next 7 weeks, I think it's probably one of, if not the funniest show of the year, certainly up there with funniest shows of the year.
Like, just to bring it back to what we were talking about at the beginning, you do know what the penultimate, like the episode 9's
CinemaCon. Name,
CinemaCon.
I'm excited for the Golden Globes episode because I cannot wait to see how many fucking people they get into the Golden Globes episode.
Okay, so like, here's my thing. Like, you remember how weird it was? Did you watch the fact that Catherine O'Hara and Seth Rogen were presenting?
Yeah.
Do you think, like, it was a very weird presentation? Do you think that their presentation was a part of the studio? Maybe. Because it was weird, right? Like, I remember, I think my wife even mentioned, like, what the fuck is going on? Are they high? Are they both high? It's fucking weird. They could
have both been high. That's very possible that Seth Rogen was high. I don't know. We'll see. I'm excited to see where the show goes from here. So lastly, and very briefly, I watched a movie on Hulu called Odessa. Adam had already seen it. I don't want to spend a lot of time on it, but I do want to say, like, I wish that more people would see this. I get why people aren't watching it. I thought the story was okay. I think the music is fantastic. And Sadie Sink should probably lean into a career as a music artist, because she's fucking great. Like, that's her singing those songs.
Yes, it is. This is a movie that I'm just going to say, it's a big swing. I was looking forward to it.
And much like Death of a Unicorn, I wish I'd have seen it in conjunction with Death of a Unicorn, because they're on kind of opposite ends, but it is like such a big, unique thing that you just don't see a lot of anymore.
No, you don't. And I have, like, like it's ironic that you said that, because they are literally like I'm keeping track of all the films that I watch in 2024 that are, or sorry, 2025 that are released in 2025. And they are literally like Death of a Unicorn is right next to Odessa, and Odessa is underneath it. And it's a big swing, but for me, it's a miss. It's a big miss.
Yeah.
Because
there's a lot of stuff that just falls a little flat or isn't really like, there's no real world building. And that's kind of a problem. If you want to care about more than just like this character getting her guitar back, and the movie kind of wants you to, because like there's this whole prophecy thing, which I know it's like pulling from other sources. We don't have to get into all that, but, I think Sadie Sink is absolutely great. The movie looks really good.
Yeah,
because it's like that world that you're supposed to be in. You feel like you're in that world. Doesn't look like it was on the volume or some dumb shit. So
no, well, I mean, they filmed it in Croatia, so like the whole thing of like this the rundown post-apocalyptic nature. That's not like, I did a little bit of research because, so like, full disclosure, the writer director of this movie, Jeremy Jasper, directed one of my favorite movies of undiscovered gems of 2017, in Patty Cakes. It's basically 8 Mile with a white girl, like a white girl. And it's a really great, like, it's a great, like, kind of like musical rye underdog story where this white girl who can rap, like, you know, like it's very what's the movie? It's Hard Out Here for a Pimp. I love that movie.
Hustle and Flow. Yeah,
it's very Hustle and Flow, but set in New Jersey, so you can expect what you can expect from it. I really liked that movie when I saw it in 2017, and I've always kept him on a list of, like, you know, guys. So when I heard that he was making this movie a couple of years ago, I was like, okay, I got to put this on a list. And then it popped up when they started, like, you know, promoting it. And I was like, why did this is like all finished and we didn't hear anything about this? And now all of a sudden it's premiering at South by Southwest, then Hulu. I'm like, and it looks impressive. Like, it looks like shot by somebody named Rena Yang.
Yeah.
It looks impressive. But for me, it just, like, I'm very disappointed. There's a world where, okay, so, like, Patty Cakes was produced by Chris Columbus. And, like, the thing about Chris Columbus is that when he's a producer on something, he very much mentors these directors. And I mean, all you have to do is watch, Nosferatu was produced by him, and the guy who directed it absolutely said, like, you know, like he's like, you know, he helped me through The Witch. Like, you know, Eggers said he worked him through The Witch, helped him. He was in the editing room. He like basically helped him construct these movies together. It's a very much a partnership. When I hear that, I absolutely can tell that Patty Cakes is that. He's not a producer on Odessa, and I feel like his Harry Potter-ness and his world building is sorely missed here in the guidance that he would have been able to give Jasper, because you're right, like, it's all for nothing. It's a lot of noise, but there's no purpose to the noise. And there's a lot of, like, ideas, but I'm like, this feels like a music video, like a great music video, but it's just extended out for an hour and 45 minutes.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of like where he, like, not, I don't want to say where he got it, but like, that's his comfort zone is the music stuff. I did a little bit of digging, and like, Short Bus, he wrote some music for that movie Short Bus, which a few years ago, like, was one of those, like, everybody was talking about it things.
Yes.
I never got around to watching it, but yeah, like, the music's really good. I really enjoy the music. I think Sadie Sink does a great job, and it looks fantastic. It just all falls a little flat half the time. So, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't want to say I was disappointed, because I didn't really have any hopes for it. It just looked unique, and, you know, I'm trying to not just watch the same shit I always watch, which is, you know, superhero stuff. But, yeah, it was just okay. You know, I didn't hate it.
Yeah.
So.
Like I said, it's a swing and a miss. Like, it's, I respect it more than I liked it, because it's culling from a lot of things that I like. Like, it's very maximalist, so it very much feels like, it very much feels like it's from the whole, it feels like, you know, the Moulin Rouge, kind of like, Elvis, what's his name? Good Lord, what is his name? The director.
The Romeo and Juliet guy.
Yeah, I can't even think of...
Baz Luhrmann.
Baz Luhrmann, yeah. It's very maximalist, like Baz Luhrmann. I love Baz Luhrmann, right? Like sometimes, like, you know, sometimes you just need loud wall of sound and imagery. But what I learned very quickly about Baz Luhrmann, whenever somebody else tries to inhibit his space... Only Baz Luhrmann can do that, because there's purpose, and he finds a way to kind of give you a world and build it through that wall of sound and wall of images. This doesn't happen here. And Sadie Sink is good. I feel like this is a role that she should have done 5 years from now, because, yeah, like,
between it's the kind of thing you can do when you have more clout and it doesn't hurt you, but when you don't have a lot of clout, it's the kind of thing that can hurt you.
Exactly. And you're absolutely right. She has the beginnings of a musical career. I very crassly called this on my Letterboxd review. I called it like Mad Mumford, Fury
yeah,
Road.
Because, yeah.
Like, it's very much of the Mumford and Sons kind of, like.
I mean, if you got Spotify, I know it's on Spotify because I looked it up.
Yes.
Just put in Odessa soundtrack, find the official thing. Listen to those. If you like folksy kind of music, like, it's fucking good, man.
Yes. It's very, like, somebody told me that it's the stomp, clap, hey genre, because that's what it is. Stomp, clap, hey. If you like that kind of music, you are going to be in for a treat, because it's really good. Like, the music, like the music is probably the best part.
Easily.
Followed by Sadie Sink, but Sadie feels like
the art direction.
Exactly. But Sadie is a little too, like I said, she's a little too young. Like, I feel like she's like literally she's like a couple of years away. If she had done this a couple of years later, I would have been
part of Sadie Sink's problem too, that is, and I feel like she's gonna bump up against this as she goes further along in her acting career. She also can't not look young.
Yeah, which is going to be a problem for me in Spider-Man, because Holland does not look young anymore. Holland looks like he's in his 20s.
Yeah.
There's like no way about it. And if she is, like, if she's going to be his love interest, I'm going to have a big problem with that, because she looks like she's 17 years old. Like, in this,
I don't even know if she looks that old.
Yeah. Like, in this movie, she definitely like
she's 23 right now. And
she doesn't even look 23.
I mean, she could pass for 15.
Yeah. I mean, like, yeah. Like, it doesn't, like, yeah. Like, she does not look, she, like, she, like, literally when they cut her hair, she looks like she's a 12-year-old in this movie.
Yeah.
Like, it really disturbs me that they have her have a relationship with Kelvin Harrison Jr., who is great as this whole kind of...
Very small, like, too small of a role. Like, there's not enough there. But, yeah, they enter in this romantic relationship, and I was watching with Stephanie, and we were both like, what? I'm like, I think she's supposed to be older than we think she is.
Yeah.
Because we're thinking she's 13 and she's supposed to be like 19 or 20.
I guess. I mean, it made it a very weird watch. Like, everything about this movie made it a very weird watch, right? And it just, like I said, it just didn't, from the beginning to the end, it didn't work for me. And I can respect it because, again, like, the visuals.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing that maybe would have become kind of a cult hit in the VHS days. Because yeah, it was so off the wall, and you'd see this, like, box art and be like, well, what is this? Like, this is weird. And then you'd watch it and be like, I don't know that I liked it, but I'm going to tell other people to watch it so that we could talk about it, you know? But ultimately, you know, like a lot of those movies, they're not really great. They're mostly just forgettable. It's just that you could only, you know, they were just the kind of thing that you ran across at the video store. So, you know, they kind of just became your thing. So,
yeah. No, absolutely. And it might be like, this might be one of those things in 20 years becomes like one of my favorite movies, Phantom of the Paradise, because Phantom of the Paradise was like, you know, it's the De Palma. I don't know if you've ever seen this, the De Palma musical.
I've never seen it, but I know about it.
I fucking love that movie. And I know, like, I remember telling my dad when I was younger, and he looked at me and he went, that piece of shit, that piece of shit. You're talking about the Paul Williams musical that he should have never have done. And I mean, like, the heartbreak I heard, like, when he had said that to me when I was a kid, was like, yes, Paul Williams, yes, that musical, that piece of shit, you say piece of shit musical. I don't know if it's going to be that. It might, because kids nowadays have a very different view of things than we do. And I don't see it. Like, I see a lot of edges. And again, in 20 years, we might be actually, you know, people might be talking about this, like I said, like the Phantom of the Paradise or Moulin Rouge, because, oh my God, when I saw this, it blew my mind, because, like, you know, they didn't see the 35,000 other post-apocalyptic movies and musicals we've seen.
Yeah. I mean, it, like I said, big swing and props to them. Like, I think everybody does a great job. The movie, it's not as good as it could have been. That's the only problem. Yeah. Like, you hear post-apocalyptic folk musical, and it's like, oh shit, that could be genius.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely my jam. I mean,
yeah, it just comes up a little bit short. So
yeah, no, absolutely, it really does. You know, and I'm not laughing because, well, I am laughing because it's just kind of like, it's a swing and a miss. Like,
yeah.
But I appreciate the big swing. Like, you know, I'm going to not say don't see it. I'm going to say watch it.
Yeah, to your credit, you did not try to talk me out of seeing it, and I didn't hate it. Like, I absolutely didn't hate it. It's just, you know, at the end of the year, when I'm thinking about the movies I watched this year, I probably will forget that I watched Odessa. So, like, unless the soundtrack does wind up, you know, because I do really, really enjoy the music. I thought it was really good. So,
cut to you at your place, and you're like, oh, fuck
no.
It.
Cut to me at work forcing my coworkers to listen to this.
Oh, that's great.
So what comes again, out next week?
Amateur.
Okay, yeah.
Or the Amateur.
Yeah, so, I'll be going to see that Friday.
I'm going to see it on. I actually got the tickets for the, because there's not an IMAX screening after it. I'm going to see the IMAX version of it on the fan appreciation thing that AMC does.
Okay.
So I want to see it. So I'll see it by Wednesday, so we can definitely talk about it.
I might see it Thursday because Stephanie's off Thursday, and so am I. So we might go see it Thursday. I think The Drop comes out this week as well. And she loves horror movies and stuff like that, so we might try to go.
No, that's next week. That's the 18th.
Oh, is it? Oh, okay.
Yeah. This week is Warfare and very weirdly competing movies. I'm actually seeing both early. So I want to see Warfare. It looks very much my jam, and it's a 90-minute movie, and I have to appreciate a war movie that isn't like 3 hours long, like most war movies are.
Yeah.
Those two are coming out. So we'll have those to talk about. And then, of course, whatever else comes. I did want to pop something off before we leave. Doesn't have to be quick, or it can be very quick. The thoughts on the, like, we didn't think we were getting any more Star Wars this year, but man, we got a little May the 4th action coming up with Tales from the Underworld.
Yeah, I think the trailer looks good. I hope it continues like their little mini animation like run. Like they're doing really good with that. So we're gonna have that and Andor coming up. I might be the only person not truly excited about Andor. Almost 2 hours of Star Wars content every week. I'm like, oh my God. Really it'll be more than that. It'll be like 3 hours of Star Wars content every week. Yeah, that's a lot. I thought the trailer was really good. It's exploring stuff that, you know, Lucas wanted to explore. I'm excited for it, but I don't have anything like, I don't know. I think Star Wars has been such a roller coaster lately that I'm just like, eh.
But like, okay, I'm going to say this, but it's Filoni and it's animation.
Yeah.
So it's two characters. Like instead of focusing on multiple things, it's two characters, two stories that I really want. Like I really want Cad Bane back, and we're getting Cad Bane, and we're actually kind of getting, it sounds like we're getting like Outlaw Josie Wales.
Yeah.
Like which fucking give me that story because I am there for that. But then also we're getting one of our favorites, Asajj Ventress, post Bad Batch, post, like, you know, like basically sequel, like, you know, post Clone Wars. We're getting her as a Force user and a Padawan type character, which, again, I'm there for. So, like, if you're giving me two, like, compact, like, short stories about these two characters, but just told over, like, say it's 12 episodes, right? 6 episodes each, 10 minutes a piece, an hour long, basically, like, story. I'm there for it. I am so there for it. And you, like you said, the animation continues to prove to be their jam because
Star Wars needs an animated property, man. I hate to.
It really does.
It's just, they did it so well for so long, and the live action stuff is good in fits and spurts, and like, until they can figure it out, like, I would really love a continual Star Wars animated thing. I missed the Bad Batch. So, I missed exploring the entire animated Star Wars universe. So, I don't know. We'll see. So, it'll be fun. I can't wait to watch it. So, we'll get into the amateur next week. And until then, go check out everything else we're doing over at xwingfiles.com. Or you can read our written work over at Adam's website.
Yes, themovieowl.com, where we've got a bunch of 4K content coming up, reviewing a bunch of stuff, some very exciting stuff you'll see in the next couple of weeks. We've got all that stuff. And we will let you go. I'm going to watch the Tron trailer that just dropped a couple of minutes ago. Nice. Yeah.
I'll check that out.
I'll have to, like, I saw images.
It's hard to get excited for anything with Jared Leto, man.
I know. But it's got we've got Jeff Bridges coming back, and we've got a Nine Inch Nails score. Like, thank God they're not doing 30 Seconds to Mars. It's Nine Inch Nails, which I've heard the concept, and I don't know if you have either. It's Tron in the Real World.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm there for that, especially if they're gonna deliver. Which, I mean, you know, $250 million budget. You can't go wrong with that. So
a lot on that last one too.
Yes, so. He did. Another movie, all sound and vision, nothing else. But I mean, we'll talk about that then.
Yeah, we'll see you guys next week.
Number 4, Mario. Number 5, Weird Al. Number 6, Batman. Number 7, Kal-El. Number 8, Simpsons. Number 9, TV. Number 10, every single band that I stole all their MP3s. But before they all sold out, say hello together if you're with me now. Nerds ruin everything.